I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability to order. And committee, I appreciate you all showing up for an informational meeting at this late date in the session. Things are pretty busy, and I know people are ready to keep moving. But I thought this informational meeting would really help us in February, taking advantage of this time while we're all here to set off perhaps some work that this committee might look at a lot of different aspects of government accountability in the interim. And so with Patrick's help, we put together a group to speak to us on some different issues about transparency and government accountability. So with that, Patrick, anything you'd like to kick us off with?
No, Mr. Chair.
We have no major introductions today?
No, we do not, Mr. Chair. That's been one thing that all the committees have been putting on all the agendas, but we do not have any major introductions today, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I think we're all set to start.
All right, with that.
My hat, we're working.
I'm going to start out with a briefing on the governor's reset cabinet, and I guess I need to open the informational meeting. And start out with a briefing on the governor's reset cabinet. And I have Tim Nesbitt and Corey Streisinger both here. Tim is the deputy chief of staff for the governor's office, and Corey is the director of Department of Consumer Business Services. And welcome to the committee. I wasn't really expecting to see Ms. Streisinger here today, but happy to have you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And
Mr. Nesbitt twisted my arm.
Well, good. So if you'd identify yourselves for the record, and I guess for our purposes of the committee, I wanted to sort of have an overview about what is going on in state government with the executive branch of government. I felt that oftentimes we in the legislative branch are always thinking about doing a lot of things with government accountability, and I think it's important for this committee at least to know what's going on in the state of Oregon. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tim Nesbitt, Deputy Chief of Staff for the Governor. And with me, as you said, is Corey Streisinger, who is, in addition to her other duties, serving as chair of the Governor's Reset Cabinet. I wanted to give you a summary of what that cabinet has been working on. First of all, it was by executive order last September that the governor created the 7-member reset cabinet to advise him on options for restructuring state government to preserve and improve critical services for Oregonians, addressing two key points. One is the prioritization of core functions, including the consolidation and elimination of boards and commissions, and improving outcomes, controlling costs, and maximizing efficiencies. You have a copy of the executive order there in my handout. I want to note that many of these same objectives are captured in House Bill 3614, which you heard 2 weeks ago. The handout also lists for you the members of the cabinet appointed by the governor, as well as its subcommittees on the back of the page there, and a timeline which gives you a sense of where we're at right now, about to next month start to reach out to stakeholders with outlines of the kinds of questions we're framing to advance this discussion and focus our recommendations, and eventually a report to the governor in June, and he in turn will have a report to the citizens of the state following receipt of our report. I want to also point out that the impetus for this initiative is the new fiscal reality we're facing this biennium and next biennium and potentially for the rest of the next decade. Some have taken to calling this the new normal. Whatever you call it, it is different. It's not pretty. It means we're looking at a deficit of $2 to $2.5 billion vis-a-vis what we call the essential budget level in the next biennium, and deficits ranging from $1.3 to $1.7 billion or so every biennium for the rest of the decade. That is, if we attempt to continue to try and fund current service levels with currently projected revenues. As one of our members observed in summarizing the reports we received from the state economist and the state's budget office, we learned the hard way that we cannot plan effectively when we try to keep balancing the budget by riding the highs in good years and avoiding the lows in bad years in what is going to be an increasingly volatile economy. At least that's what the economists are telling us about this new normal. So the conclusion then becomes, when the path we're on leads to one fiscal cliff after another in future biennia, we have to look for different paths forward. And that's what led the governor to ask for both a reprioritization of our current commitments and a renewed effort to find better ways to meet those commitments. Now, I use the term commitments to apply equally to a spectrum of responsibilities, functions, and services, which we can also call core. I want to share with you then how we've organized the effort to focus on these commitments or responsibilities. First, we've been focusing on the general fund for several reasons, and one is that we find the functions. This is where we find the functions of government that we choose to support with broad-based taxes. And these are the functions that provide benefits to all of us. Think of public safety, public health, and education, or to those of us who generally agree deserve our help, as in health and human services. This is where the fiscal squeeze is tightest, where the fiscal projections give the greatest concern. And finally, past attempts to prioritize functions supported by the general fund against those supported by dedicated funds have proven only marginally helpful, and Corey can talk to you about her experience with that in 2005. Of course, it's critical that all programs demonstrate added value regardless of fund source. Second, as we focused on the responsibilities and functions supported by the state's general fund, we've come to appreciate greater connections to the local level, to counties and schools and community colleges, which bring their own general funds to what have become our common responsibilities. So the same public safety, public health, and education functions that we struggle with at the state level, they struggle with at the local level. Decisions made by officials and funds paid by taxpayers at both levels, local and state, affect these common functions. So this is why we're pleased to see the efforts of the task force that you'll hear more about from Mike MacArthur this afternoon, as well as efforts such as the Post-Secondary Quality Education Commission and the recent Race to the Top collaboration. Also the case for the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission, which is currently underway. The reset cabinet is going to monitor and draw on the work of all of these efforts, which are parallel to its efforts. Let me share with you also how we're approaching the prioritization exercise, which remains a work in progress. We recognize there are value judgments in this exercise. We recognize that core functions are critical by definition, just using that term. And we are looking at core functions which encompass safety of our communities, health of our communities, access to education, life-sustaining services for the poor, protection and support for our most vulnerable, as well as the general functions of government, such as elections. But however we rank these functions and services, we recognize that costs and demands are going up faster than resources in all those areas. And this leads us to another set of values, empirical values, where we will look for not just what we choose to invest in or spend our money on, but how well we spend our money. So it's not just a matter of adjusting our core functions to available resources, but it's also a matter of looking at the responsibilities that underlie each of those functions and determining how best we can meet those responsibilities. That's why we did a 10-year projection of both revenues and demands, looking at both demographic trends and economic forecasts. And that's why I'm able to give you projections beyond the scope of the usual kinds of revenue forecasts you receive on out through the end of the next decade. In health and human services, we're taking a hard look at the consequences of the aging of the baby boom generation and asking ourselves what we can do now to reduce costs a decade from now. In K-12 education, we're building on the collaborations of the Race to the Top and the goals of the quality education model. in regard to post-secondary education, which we call education beyond high school. We're following the work of the Post-Secondary Quality Education Commission to chart a path to 40-40-20, where 40% of our adults will have a four-year degree, 40% will have a two-year degree or a workforce certificate of some kind, and 20% will be at least high school graduates. Right now, we're more like 29-14-25, with 11% of our adult population not even having a high school degree. And we're also digging deeply into the proposals for restructuring of the Oregon university system. In public safety, we're looking at diminishing marginal returns on incarceration in the context of sentencing practices, the relationship of local jails to state prisons, the system of supervision for inmates returning to their communities, and the related issue of alcohol and drug treatment. In regards to boards and commissions, we've asked the DAS director to report back to us in March on the potential for elimination and consolidations. Also on the list for the full cabinet is the issue of the stability of the revenue system we have now, but not the assumption of any new general fund resources to come. You can expect to hear more from the cabinet on kicker reform connected to the creation of an emergency reserve fund in the Constitution. And finally, we'll be looking at the state's labor costs, taking a look again at PERS, both prior reforms and future trends, the Public Employees Benefit Board and health care costs, and the total compensation of state employees compared to their counterparts in the private sector. And as you can see from the handout, we expect the final report to be issued in June, following which there will be opportunity for more discussion and debate, including consideration by committees of this body prior to the 2011 session. That gives you the overview, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. I appreciate that overview. I just want to hone in on one for a second, and you may or may not have a response to this, because it may be really early at looking at some of these issues. You mentioned restructuring the Oregon university system, and so I'm wondering what sort of concepts are being talked about, because I have heard some in my neck of the woods as well.
Mr. Chair, I think all of you and your colleagues received a report from President Frommeyer, formerly the president of the University of Oregon, outlining one set of concepts for restructuring the system. Following that, there have been reports from the president of PSU, a letter signed by the presidents of all the seven universities, and another report from the president of OSU, and we're expecting to see one also from the president of U of O. So all of those were the subject of a meeting of the subcommittee of the Reset Cabinet a few weeks ago. We're convening again just before the Board of Higher Education meets first Friday in March to meet with the presidents again to continue to discuss some of those concepts. I think it's been reviewing for us to focus on that goal of 40-40-20 and how far we are from achieving it, and look at the resources we have in place now and the capacity we have now to educate a new generation of Oregonians, and ask ourselves how we're going to get there with the general fund support we have now. As you heard, the governor has asked us in our recommendations to consider that state general fund support will be generally fixed. He's not asking us to bring forward any new revenue-raising proposals. Now you can say you've been there and done that. So if that's the case, if in this equation, which we hope gets us to, if not 40-40-20, then higher levels of education for young adults and working-age adults, and we have a fixed resource in the general fund, what are the other resources we can bring to bear? And then I call X the general fund resource. Y is the other kinds of resources. And Z is how we spend the money to get maximum efficiency. In the Z category for post-secondary education, we have the ability to be bringing more college-level courses into the high schools, better preparing our high school graduates to move into community college or a four-year college, and ways we can better articulate and coordinate the credits students earn among those sectors. In the Y column, other resources, we have tuition. It's one of the only areas in those I mentioned where there's that kind of resource. We don't charge tuition for high school. We charge tuition for college. And we are kind of maxing out what we expect working families to provide in that area. But we also have the potential for resources from donors and from partners in the private sector. And that's an area we spent a lot of time on in talking with the presidents about their ability to expand capacity. And I think we're looking at those proposals that I mentioned that came forward and other ways to configure those to bring more resource into the system and achieve those goals.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I just have been trying to figure out how that private resource comes into the equation, and not that I don't look forward to that private resource, but also maintaining the public mission and providing access to an education. And so that always becomes tricky. So
exactly what we're asking ourselves, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Mr. Nesbitt, for that information and presentation. I wish we'd have done it a year earlier, and I hope you have the success with this that you had with the shared responsibility model, which I think was a good proposal. I have two quick questions. You haven't talked about working with other states, especially our state to the north, in sharing resources or missions. In the city of Bend and Deschutes County, they met and looked at things that one could do for both. Are you doing that with the state of Washington or California? And how can citizens or legislators provide input? Are you waiting? You don't want those till after June. Could you comment on that, please?
Mr. Chair and Representative, on your first question about coordination with other states, not something we've dug into. I mean, we've been receiving input from the NGA, but your question's one I'll take back. I think that deserves more attention. I mean, we have looked at what other states are doing in regard to higher ed in particular or other areas. But in terms of better coordination or kind of a regional approach to some services, that's something we can certainly take back to the cabinet. We're hoping in the next phase of our work in March and April to be circulating questionnaires in all the subcommittee areas that I've mentioned to those who have an interest in what we're debating. And in fact, we'll be framing questions which will give insight into the kinds of policy discussions we're having and seek guidance as well. And so where we're leaving something out, where you don't see a question addressed you think could be addressed, I'm sure we'll hear that and be able to accommodate that. And then, as I mentioned earlier, following release of the report, we expect there may be a handoff to committees of this body, perhaps another commission, if one is warranted in any of these program areas that the governor proposes to create one. But we see this work as ongoing.
Just, Mr. Chair, just quick, thank you for those comments. I wasn't talking about just education for working with other states. Minnesota and Wisconsin did a single purchase for gravel for their roads during the winter or something like that, aspects like that we could look at. And I appreciate the fact you're going to come back and ask us, but if we have an idea like the sharing of other states, could we put those into the chairs of those committees now? So something to look at. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Tim, for the presentation. I caught a few minutes in my office. Talk a little more about the plan to get this move the report into governance as we move into, you know, sort of a new governor, whomever it is, a new session of the legislature, a new budgeting process. Talk about how either stuff like this has helped transition to the past. Is it, you know, folks like Corey, maybe I missed a portion of that, but that where agency heads champion it, can we work with, you know, legislators, ways and means? Talk a little more about that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, again, the final report will be the governor's report to the citizens of the state.
Yeah.
It could be that the report itself will contain recommendations for other commissions, boards, or work groups to take up on, you know, something that requires more detailed work between proposal and implementation. The governor does want this to be something which offers a menu of options rather than a prescription in any one area for how to get things done. Mostly he's focused on how daunting the challenge is to maintain the level of service that we have been providing in all these key areas up through now. And it's challenging us to do a lot of creative thinking and leave no questions unanswered as to how to organize things in a different way, which is why I also use that term responsibility rather than functions and services. Because you back up to the responsibility, I think you can kind of broaden the scope of what you consider to be answers to these questions. Mm-hmm. In some cases, I've in the process of staffing the Education Beyond High School subcommittee, I've talked to your colleagues who chair the policy committees in both chambers, and they, a couple months ago, expressed an interest in perhaps taking up the recommendations from that subcommittee in their committees in the interim, following this session, following June, and in preparing for the 2011 session. So that's one example that could work in that area, and I think there may be similar examples in the other policy areas.
One follow-up?
Certainly.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just want to applaud you. I think it's really interesting work, and to the extent there we can tie connective tissue either to, you know, ways and means types or to legislative leadership of both parties, and or a really weird one would be gubernatorial candidates from both parties. That'd be sort of interesting. If we have some consensus things queuing up 2011, that could be interesting, and I know there's other things we need to cover.
Thank you. I wanted to make sure that Ms. Streisinger had a moment to make some comments if she wishes.
Mr. Chair, I don't feel I need to add to what Mr. Nesbitt summarized in terms of the current work of the Reset Cabinet. My understanding is that in your prior session, you also had some questions about some of the past work that had been done on a multi-agency level concerning prioritization, and I also know that you have a full schedule. I'm happy to talk a little about that if you'd like to, or if you would like to postpone that to another day, we can do that as well.
Well, if you would like to just comment on,
sure,
on some of the things in the past, I know we have our hands on a report from 2004, Making Government Work for Oregonians, from the Advisory Committee on Government Performance and Accountability, that came out and, you know, I guess was filled with recommendations too, which maybe this Reset Cabinet was one of those recommendations. But if you wanted to give us a brief little synopsis or whatever you feel might be helpful to us to provide us, a little bit of knowledge about where we've been and where we're going.
Sure, Mr. Chair. And for the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. As Tim mentioned, I'm on the Reset Cabinet, and I also was on the Advisory Committee on Government Performance and Accountability, as well as heading the Governor's Regulatory Streamlining effort. So that's where some of the overlap comes. I'm going to give you two handouts. One of them is really just background reading, and it was an interim report following up on that advisory committee report that was sort of a number of months later. How are we doing? What progress are we making? A snapshot, if you will, about which of those recommendations we were moving forward with and how. And some of them, frankly, were ones that the decision was made that it wasn't advisable to move forward with. The second packet, which I actually wanted to spend a minute on, was a more in-depth follow-up to one of the key, probably the most high-priority recommendation in that advisory committee report, and that had to do with priorities of government and how do we look across programs and do some prioritization. And so some of you may remember, coming into the 2005 legislative session, the governor actually asked all executive branch agencies to do an in-depth evaluation of the priorities of their programs. And I just want to walk you through this packet very briefly and show you what that involved. The cover sheet is all agencies were asked to fill out extremely detailed spreadsheets. The tiny, tiny type in the back is a couple of examples of those spreadsheets. I didn't give you the bedsheet-sized versions, which had the advantage of being legible, because rather than the content, I wanted to show you a little more about the type of work. And I just pulled two agencies at random. I believe this is PERS and the Liquor Control Commission, but all agencies did these. They were asked to break down all of their functions into a reasonable degree of granularity, and then for each of those programs, answer a series of questions, or rather provide a series of data. First of all, to identify what core function of government, what reason for government's existence does it tie to? And if you look at the second page of your handout, you'll see the governor articulated a set of half a dozen major principles, and his view was that's what government should be doing, and if it doesn't fit within one of these, then why are we doing it? So agencies were asked to identify what's the purpose, which of these principles does each program support? Secondly, what performance measures do you have to know how you're doing? And what outcome measures? So not just the formal performance measures that are part of the budget process, but also what metrics are there? How do you compare to other states, for example? How do you know whether your program is working? What measurements do you have that actually tell you about that program? What evidence of return do you have? Cost-benefit analysis. What return on investment are you getting? So you'll see several columns that where agencies were actually asked to give us that data. And if you don't have any, maybe you should see if you can go find some. Is it a legally mandated program? Is it something that we must do? And either because it's a federal requirement or a statutory requirement or a constitutional requirement. Do we provide the service directly, or is government simply a pass-through of funds for somebody else out there to provide the service? And if so, who is it? Who's actually doing the service? Does government need to be involved, or could it be provided by private sector, by a nonprofit, by somebody else? How broad is the impact? How many citizens are affected? And then anything else that should be thought about in terms of prioritizing and evaluating the programs. Then each of these, there were issue cluster committees that went through and vetted the work of other agencies, so this wasn't just an agency doing their own work. They were all posted on a website, and there were outreach meetings around the state and comments solicited, and then these were used as the basis for agency budget submittals in the 2005 session. And the Legislative Fiscal Office and the leadership came up with their own set of core principles, which matched to some degree but weren't identical, and agencies were asked to then reprioritize based on those. So I would say in terms of how much it actually drove budget decisions, I would probably defer to members of this body to answer that. I'm not sure that it actually drove key budget decisions that much. In terms of how we in the executive branch think about our programs, I think it was extremely useful, and particularly with respect to the metrics. It really caused all of us to say, what gives me reason to think this program is working? Or if it's not working, what do I know about it, and should I be doing it? So the actual discipline of saying I really need to know how to measure outcomes, measure return on investment, I think was very helpful and provoked a lot of extremely valuable discussions, which then also I think were discussions that went forward with the Ways and Means Committee. So that's some of our history. I will say the reset work is not replicating this work. This was a great deal of granularity. I think as Tim has described, what we are trying to function on in the reset work is where are the really large areas for which general fund support is being that are supported by general fund. Fundamentally, are there completely different ways we can think about doing what we're doing in those areas? So it's not this type of granular program by program. Both approaches are valid, and wanted you to have the background of what we had done a few years ago. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate your going over that for us. That's really seems like a lot of work that has been done already on a lot of these issues. So as much as we can glean from that, I think it's important for us to hear from you. I didn't know you were so busy to take that on as well as your regular duties. I am completely in awe of how you managed to get all that done. But,
well, Mr. Chair, you haven't seen the product yet.
So. Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of specific questions, and then I'd like to just ask something as a thought experiment. But
Representative Wingard, I hope that you can get some of your questions out, because I do have a number of other people left to testify, so it's not my intention to go on for a half an hour of questioning, so just so you know.
Fantastic, Mr. Chair. I am enjoying the informational hearing. To follow up on Representative Wisnett's question, as an example of trying not necessarily to reinvent the wheel, but maybe to look out across this fruited plain of ours and capitalize on some work that other folks have done, just to give you a bipartisan example, you have Governor Mitch Daniels in Indiana and Governor Richardson in New Mexico, both of whom did basically core functions examinations, trying to figure out how they could order things that their state does in order to be able to make decisions based on limited revenue. And, you know, I just would recommend to the group that they take a look at both of those and try to, you know, again, just save yourself some time, because a lot of what states do is not fundamentally different. It may be structurally different, but it's not fundamentally different from state to state, and I don't think we necessarily have to reinvent that. So just for instance, and this just happens to be a kind of a personal thing of mine, but when you're examining, for instance, on the healthcare or public employee side, will the governor's panel take it down far enough to ask the question of whether or not, say, transitioning to fully funded health savings accounts for all public employees and what that might potentially do savings-wise, both for the taxpayers and actually end up being additional revenue to employees, most public employees. I mean, are those kinds of specific ideas going to be considered by the governor's panel?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wingard, we haven't yet scheduled the presentation from the director of PAB, who's going to be coming into a future meeting, and I'm assuming we'll get into as many proposals as she and the cabinet think are specific to solving the problem. We did have a similar presentation from the director of PERS. And everything was on the table. We had a very far-ranging discussion about what we've accomplished with the PERS reforms and what is yet and what the problem remains, given the losses suffered in the fund, and how we have to figure out a way to stabilize and adequately fund a defined benefit there. Again, we'll take the discussion where the cabinet feels it needs to go. We're not going to have any artificial restrictions on the discussion. We're not going to have any sacred cows not to be considered. And in regard to what other states are doing, we have very much tracked the experience in Indiana in particular. We had a handout for the cabinet about what's going on in that state. And again, we have this national survey from the NGA that we expect to get more information on. A lot of states are doing the same thing, and a lot of states are calling it exactly the same thing. They're calling it a reset effort. So we hope to benefit from their efforts as well.
Final question, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. My perspective on the issue of coming at something that we lovingly refer to as core functions budgeting, whatever term we want to give it, at the end of the day, everything that the government does has a constituency, and it's a core to someone. So I think it may be a mistake to think of it in terms of trying to establish, what is core and is not core. I think at the end of the day, the only way I know to tackle this is to ultimately rank things, to take all of the things the government does, and even within areas, for instance, it could be within like food stamps or something, you could still break that up by the income level of the people that are receiving it. You really break it down. And then ultimately, you just have to decide the way you're going to rank things and make, ultimately, it's about getting to know, which is one of the hardest things that government does, is just to tell a constituency, based on the amount of money we have and the other things that are in line ahead of your thing, the answer has to be no. Because it just seems to me that if the question becomes just, does it fit one of these very nice, broad-based statements that the governor made, just about anything could fit into one of those statements. And if the question is it core, again, it'll be somebody's core. It ultimately has to be about a certain amount of revenue and what the highest priorities are going to be based on that revenue, and it's going to leave a lot of things off. There will always be things that will be off.
Corey helped us a lot in this discussion in an earlier meeting, Mr. Chair, and Representative, maybe I'll let Corey answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingert, I think there's a third answer, actually, because it's true that everything is core to the constituency who has advocated for that program, and particularly when there are differing fund sources and a particular program is being paid for by a small group of people for whom it's worth it, trying to rank those, frankly, the exercise that we went through in 2005 did not feel like it produced major change for exactly that reason. I think what we're trying to do with the reset cabinet is neither to decide what's core and what's not, nor to rank every program in priority order, but to say, are there completely different ways we can do some of these things? So that if the goal is public safety, or the goal is 40% of Oregonians having four-year degrees and 40% having two-year degrees and 20% having high school diplomas, can we get there in different ways than the ways we've been traditionally doing it, rather than saying, of the programs that that are aimed at that, how do we rank them in priority order? So we may succeed, we may not, our goal is actually to try to lay out a menu of options of how to think about some things differently.
If I could add, we recognize the word core implies don't touch it, or it's so important that it shouldn't go away, but the core functions or responsibilities, as we've discussed them, are not absolute. And so there's always the prioritization within core functions, and there's always the pursuit of better ways to get things done and expand what we can do or maintain what we can do with the limited resources we have.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments, and it's a great discussion. Representative Winger asked a good question, I think, and I appreciate that, you know, the governor's office especially is taking this issue on for the agencies to look at their operations, and certainly, you know, they can identify their cores and how to perhaps better do it than they are today. And we always look for efficiencies no matter what agency or corporation or public or private sector always is looking for more efficient ways to do things. But certainly I think there's one piece that I guess that I appreciate is the interface with the legislature, I suppose, in that the governor, the executive branch coming up with this list, I guess, of core functions and how they prioritize their agencies also has to interface with the budgeting side of the legislature. Our Ways and Means process essentially would go through recommendations from the executive branch and then go through it again and basically prioritize it with real dollars every session. Can you comment about, I suppose, how you see that interface changing in the future based on this reset committee recommendation?
Mr. Chair, I'd say it gets down to the end product, whose value to you we hope will be as compelling as its analysis, findings, and recommendations. And if you're yawning and reading it, we haven't done our job. If you have some aha moments, because we've pulled on the best thinking of the agency heads and the others who've been working on these issues for many years and can give you some new insights, that should be its value.
Thank you. I appreciate that final statement. I thank you so much for coming here today. I'm going to move on with some other topics and thank the governor's office for me, or you are the governor's office, I suppose. Thank you very much, and thank the governor for allowing you the time to come here and brief us on what you're doing. I think it's a great effort, and I hope we stay in contact with the outcomes of it. Thank you, committee. I'm actually running a little bit behind schedule. Up next, we have a briefing on the Task Force on Effective and Cost-Efficient Services Provision. Mike MacArthur, Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Counties, will be presenting that. And I believe, was this not the result of a bill last session, this task force, House Bill 2940? 2920. So I appreciate your time here, and if you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Members of the committee, I'm Mike MacArthur, Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Counties, and my technical advisor here, Eric Schmidt. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this important work. The association's providing staff support for the 2920 task force, which, as you say, was created by the 2009 legislature. The 2920 task force is really the merger of a couple of different ideas that were very similar or facing similar problems. Representative Nathanson had the notion that there's never going to be enough revenue to do all the things that we need to do in government. I think we're feeling that increasingly. The Association of Counties was facing a situation of dire consequences for certain counties as a result of the removal of federal forest payments. And we had just gone through the process with the Federal Forest Payments Task Force, chaired by Tim Nesbitt, who was just here, driven by Tim. And one of the first recommendations of that task force was that we convene what's known as county planning councils to deal with the consequences of the disappearance of those federal funds. So 2920 merged both of those ideas. And so we support very much what Representative Nathanson's vision was, and Representative Nathanson was helping us achieve the goal of the Federal Forest Payments Task Force. So we've created this task force, and we'll get into the website here in a moment. But I think the premise, as I said, is the tax system we have isn't going to provide generous revenues to do a bunch of new things. As we've found, changes in the income tax system can be somewhat controversial. The property tax systems are very constrained. And as the Federal Forest Payments Task Force found, there's limited amount of movement in the property tax system for even those counties with very low tax rates. So what we tried to do is identify where we can find efficiencies. And I think in Representative Nathanson's mind, if I can go from what she's told me, there are perhaps efficiencies to be found in technology. There are efficiencies to be found in reorganization, perhaps, of government structures, and there are certainly efficiencies to be found in best practices if we can identify and highlight them. Part of the problem is there's never really been a place where governments can come together, different levels of governments, state, county, city, special districts, to talk about how we deliver services. I've provided you with a copy of our famous shared services charge. That's the deluxe placemat version, by the way. We could talk a lot about how this all works, but you see across the top in the green are those services provided with only state funding and state direction. Those services in the red are provided with a combination of county general fund dollars and state support, with some state direction and some county authority. And those services in the blue on the bottom are provided exclusively with county resources. So in order to have this discussion, we needed to have a conversation with state agency folks and county folks and others who are involved in delivering of all these services. Well, this is too daunting to take it all on, and so the 2920 task force tried to break it down into some specific areas. And what we're looking at is reviewing opportunities to provide services in the most cost-effective manner. And we're considering the ability of intergovernmental agreements, existing or new service districts, and technology to achieve cost savings, encourage effective physical planning for counties managing the phase-out of federal forest payments, and to recommend to the governor and legislative assembly an appropriate level of funding for some of those financial services. So one of the things that Representative Nathanson's tried to do with this task force is to walk the talk. And we're trying to run this task force as efficiently as possible. And to do that, with her staff, Dorothy Waller, created this website that most all the information you'd want to know about this task force is on this website. And we're going to run through this real quickly here to show you what's available. First of all, the calendar. We have to report back by November. You can see we've got a very aggressive timeline, and also that limits what we may be able to do. It's my hope that we find some early successes, we're able to identify some things that are doable, and that you'll recreate this task force in the 011 biennium, and we'll be able to continue this work. So you can see the reports are definitely going to be done by August, modification, final review by middle of September. You'll have this, any recommendations we have, going into next session. Let's look at members of the task force, Eric. The regular membership. Regular. So the legislation called out who should be on it. There are county commissioners, there are representatives of special districts, cities, there are four legislators, the Secretary of State, Chief Justice, and you can see agencies. The areas that we're looking at constitute the subcommittees. We limited what we're looking at to five areas. We're looking at human services, and the chair of the human services subcommittee is in the back of the room here, Susanna Hoffman from DHS. We're looking at assessment and taxation. Department of Revenue Director Elizabeth Harshenko is heading up that subcommittee. We're looking at public safety, or criminal justice, I guess, and Deputy Superintendent Chris Brown is leading that effort. We're looking at elections, and Kate Brown's office is leading that effort. So those are the four specific areas where we're looking right now at efficiencies. We're also looking at the situation facing the federal forest payments counties, and that's called the Planning Council. That Planning Council is made up of commissioners from five of the hard-hit counties and chaired by Commissioner Susan Morgan of Douglas County. That's been very interesting work to look at what's going on there. As you recall, there's a ramp down of federal forest payments. Many of those counties have averaged those out, and they will be planning for the basic disappearance of those as they go into their budget sessions next spring, 11-12. The 11-12 year, we ramp down to that very low level, and after that, we don't know if there'll be anything. So like in Josephine County, we were seeing that they'll be reducing their public safety efforts by over 50% in the 11-12 budget year. So how we're going to deal with that is the focus of the Planning Council. We've got on the subcommittees, we've got some summaries of what their work is. Eric, if you look at assessment taxation, for instance, you can see work plans there, what they're looking at, potential cost savings, efficiencies, and so on. And you can also find minutes here when you go to each of these. Let's look at a
link on the survey that we're asking people to take on that as well.
Okay, Eric points out there's a link to the survey we're asking folks who have something to say about property tax to go here. In human services in particular, there's a number of other processes underway, and I think what we'll be able to do is draw from those other processes rather than recreate the wheel. So you can see that there's the members, Suzanne's contact, and their schedule of meetings. So I think that pretty well sums up, and like I say, this is a resource available to you. Eric, what's the link? It's a Google site.
It's a Google site. It's HB 2920 Task Force, Mr. Chair.
No dots or anything, just HB 2920 Task Force?
You have to do the www stuff first, but if you Google HB 2920 Task Force, it'll be there.
Okay, great. Thank you. I appreciate that quick summary of what's going on with that, and I've heard a little bit about it from Representative Nathanson, and it looks like a pretty good exercise and hopefully with some fruitful outcomes. I really applaud you. Just, you know, it's such a daunting task, but just to pick something and do it, you know, and that way you're actually getting something done. And because I imagine when I look at this at the first glance, my head starts swimming because there's so much to look at and so much to do. And certainly I appreciate that you've identified some specific things that you're working on and getting after it right now. I think, a good step. So I appreciate any comments. Representative Wisniak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, in the 1980s, Democratic Senator Sam Nunn directed the Department of Defense to audit their, doing operational management audits of all their departments, and every year you have to confirm it's cheaper to keep it in-house than to contract it out. Are you looking at contracting out any of these services?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisden, I think we're looking at all the options.
Thank you. I appreciate your presentation today, and at least now we know who to call if we have more questions about it, and I Thank you very much for taking the time to be here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add that we're also benefit from the staffing from the governor's office. Ray Knapp's office is also helping on this. And I also want to reiterate how important I think it is to have this place for this work to take place. We haven't had it in the past. In order for us to find efficiencies in government, we have to work together at all levels. And I hope this can be perpetuated in the future. I hope we can show success.
Yeah, I hope so too. And I hope that we're able as a body to stay more informed about what you are doing. And that's one of my goals, is to help educate and inform the legislature about some of these programs and how important they are to providing services. So, again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you'd like additional copies of this, we have plenty. So
I'd
be more than happy
to
bring
back
them
to you.
He'll give you 12. So you got placemats.
Thank you. Next up, we have Suzanne Hoffman from the Department of Human Services talking to us about the Transformation Initiative. Good afternoon. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Suzanne Hoffman. I'm the Chief of Staff to Dr. Bruce Goldberg at the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. And what's being handed to you is what I hope will be a very brief presentation. I won't go over everything in detail in the interest of time, but wanted you to just have it for some background information. And I was asked to talk with you just to give you a very high-level overview of our transformation initiative. We're in the middle of an implementation phase of that, but I'll talk to you a little bit about what that means and why we're doing it, what we've accomplished, and where we're going from here.
Great. Thanks. Perfect.
On the second page, where we say what is transformation, it's really we're calling it catalyst, but it's a method by which we believe we can improve our service delivery, we can increase our efficiency, and enhance our effectiveness at meeting our mission. On page 3, we talk about lean, which many of you may have heard of. It's used in many organizations. It began in manufacturing. It's used in healthcare. It can be applied in office settings, but it's basically a process by which we eliminate waste and keep the value-added activities in place. But it's a lot more than that. It really is about a leadership approach that is different, about a management philosophy, and about a set of tools that are very specific that we use to get there. On page 4, why we chose that particular methodology. Different organizations use different things, and as they become more sophisticated, they often add in things like Six Sigma and other more complicated or more comprehensive forms of quality improvement. We chose Lean because we felt it was something we could implement in our environment. Certainly challenging, but we're doing it. We chose it because it's a way that we can reduce errors and improve quality. And we chose it because it's a way that we can create standards that are really owned by the workforce. They really have a large stake in improving their own processes, which is part of what makes this successful. If you look at page 5, it describes what we mean by really paying attention to the knowledge that our workforce brings to this work. And we worked with a firm called Kaufman Global, as you can see on this page. They helped us with a pilot project in our finance area that we achieved some impressive results in that caused us to take this out department-wide. The idea is that as important as executive vision and strategy is, and it is important, it is critical, it is probably 1-2% of your leverage in improving an organization. And management direction is also very important. It's critical, but it's only about 5-20% of what really moves an organization forward. As you can see, it's the talent or the front line of your workforce that really contributes the greatest percentage toward moving the organization in a progressive direction. And Lean helps us capitalize on that. On page 6 and 7, we describe two of the main tools that we're using that we found to be most effective in our pilot project, and we're rolling them out across the department now. One is rapid process improvements, or what we call RPIs. Those are very structured events. We have trained lean leaders that conduct these events and facilitate them. And it essentially involves everyone in a group of work units that touches a process. They get very clear on what the current process is, knocking down all the mythology and the layers that may have built over time, identify all the waste or redundancies or the things that don't add value in that process, and go about removing them and redesigning that process in a more efficient and effective way for everyone. These can be half-day events. They can be three-day events. It depends on the scope of the process involved. But this is where the workforce is really empowered to bring their knowledge to the table. It's not usually top executives or middle managers who know the details of every process. It's the people who work with them every day, and this is the way to bring them in a very powerful way. We've had this also is a method of improving morale. We've had folks come and say, I don't have time to step away from my desk for 3 days to be a part of whatever this is that you're putting in front of me. And then at the end of that 3 days, say that it was so worth it, that they can't believe what they've achieved in the way of improvements. And we'll go back and tackle that three-day backlog on their desk gladly and come back and do another one of these events, because they can see the benefit it's going to bring in the long term for everyone. And then we anchor this, because these efforts can go by the wayside, as you know, in organizations and certainly in bureaucracies. Layers just build back up again. You can improve a process and then 2 months later go look at it and lots of steps somehow magically got built back in. We're anchoring this for sustainability with something that's called the Lean Daily Management System. And it's a way of forming our work teams following these events to ensure that the process, the integrity of the process improvement, stays in place. And that if any changes are made in the future to that process, they're made with the input of the people doing the work and with lean thinking in mind. On 8 and 9, we talk a little bit more about what that Lean Daily Management System is. Again, we worked closely with Kauffman Global to learn how to do this, are still learning how to do it. Really, we're in our infancy stage as a department in learning how to do this. But it really is a way of increasing communication. It's a way of changing the role of the manager. Traditionally, I think in most agencies and maybe most organizations, managers are making a lot of day-to-day decisions. That if workers or work teams had the right metrics and the right tools and the right support, could be making themselves throughout the day, leaving the manager to really focus on a larger picture, setting parameters, and really playing a larger leadership role, which means getting barriers out of the way of the people who are trying to make progress. So that is some of what this particular system brings to our organization. And it's a culture shift for us, and we're teaching our managers how to be different and how to help this be successful. On page 9, it shows you what a primary visual display looks like. This is one of the tools involved in the system that a work team uses in order to measure themselves in these various categories of quality, cost, productivity, and different things. It's very low-tech. Don't want to diminish the importance of technology. We have lots of technology means, and they will help us to become more lean. But really, this is a process that any work unit can use, and you don't need a lot of technology to do it. On page 10, we talk about our finance pilot. When Dr. Goldberg joined the department, we had a pretty significant budget problem. It was well over $100 million at the time. We asked Kauffman Global to work with us, along with a private citizen volunteer who you may have met or heard of, John Ramsey, who's a former vice president with Lockheed Martin. He's retired and really wants to make a difference in government, and he's been our mentor and our guide along the way with this process. And he was with us during the finance pilot. Some of our successes, which are reflected on page 10, that caused us to say this has merit, this has potential, and we should really take it out across the department, is that one employee suggestion led to, at the time, an $8.4 million cost avoidance or revenue generation in an area of our department that either collects back payments that should never have gone out the door to begin with, or ensures that if third-party insurance coverage is available, that coverage applies first, as opposed to placing someone erroneously on the Oregon Health Plan, for example. So that was a success that came out of an employee suggestion out of one work unit. Pretty substantial. We had problems getting our budgets in on time. As you know, we're a large agency. And through this process, eliminated enough rework and what we call workarounds, inefficient ways of doing things, to where we submitted our budgets 5 months earlier than we had the previous biennium. and corrected enough of the problems that we had within our finance area that we actually received the State Controller's Gold Star Award for financial reporting, which was quite an accomplishment to be proud of for our finance area. So all of this through certainly strong leadership in the department, strong support by Dr. Goldberg, but the lean processes that we used definitely were our foundation in achieving these results. As we took it out across the department, if you look at page 12, we have five themes. We have more than 80 different initiatives that are in our roadmap to pursue for improvement. We categorized them into five themes. Doing the work the right way is all about lean and the implementation I just talked about. Developing world-class people and culture is really about how we give performance feedback and embark on leadership development of a quality nature all across the department, how we hire, how we train. Working across divisions, as you probably know, DHS is a very siloed organization, and so working across those silos to make better connections and work more effectively as a system is one of our themes. Getting more with the public dollar is all about strategic sourcing and how we purchase. And if you have other questions about what we're doing there, Stella Transu, who's going to talk to you a little bit later, is our head of contracts and procurement, could talk with you about that as well. And then engaging with our partners. So as Mike mentioned previously, with relationship to Representative Nathanson's task force on 2920, we also have been pursuing how to work better with our county partners in the area of human services and have a range of initiatives that we're working on there to improve how we work together, to reduce administrative burdens, and to help the counties who are interested in doing so also implement lean methodology and helping them with some training and some resources. Page 13 talks about some of our early successes with our department-wide effort, probably the most impressive being the first one, in that our Oregon State Hospital reduced the length of time it took to recruit a nurse, which was up at 80 days or more at the time we took it on, and are down to 20 days. We actually have a zero vacancy rate right now, which is almost unheard of. The industry standard for hiring nurses in terms of cycle time is 7 days, but for us to get to 20 is a big accomplishment for us. And when we can hire nurses faster, when we can fill our vacancies and be appropriately staffed at the hospital, it means we use fewer contract nurses, and contract nurses cost more. It also means we have less overtime, and overtime is expensive. So this was a big accomplishment. It happened through a rapid process improvement event where a lot of people came together and just took the waste and the redundancies and the unnecessary steps out of a process. And we want to replicate that now all across the department with our hiring. And our other significant result is in our self-sufficiency program on pages 14, 15, and 16. It used to be when you needed an appointment for food stamps, you might wait as long as 10 days or more just for your appointment to be able to bring in your documentation and find out if you're eligible. In the meantime, you have a family to feed, so maybe you're going to the food bank, you're going to other places, but life is very difficult. We have a completely redesigned intake process where you get same-day or next-day service, and that has been implemented statewide, one standard process in all of our offices across the state. We have done that at a time when it would have been challenging enough, but with the economy the way it was and the increased numbers of citizens coming in needing those services in some areas of the state, as much as a 45% or more increase of people coming in the door, we were actually able to manage that increased volume and still keep that same day or next day service in place. We did some surveying just as this was rolling out to about 64 of our offices and had a 98% client satisfaction rate, 75% staff satisfaction rate. Thought that was pretty good for the staff. It was very challenging for staff to implement. They had to really set aside their desire for local control for a while and implement this standard to see how they could work with it in their local areas. And this was just dealing with how people come in the door and get services. It really didn't address any backlogs that currently existed or ongoing work that was also on the plates of the workers who were implementing this. So thus, I think that their slightly lower satisfaction rate, although still impressive, reflects some of their concerns about how this new model would play out in the long term, which we'd want them to be worrying about, really. And then on the last page, 17, just we always want to keep reality in front of us. And in terms of these list of reasons, which are pretty commonly published about various organizational transformation efforts and what can cause them to fail, we've probably come really dangerously close to every single one of these along the way. We have lots of lessons learned, and we've been very transparent about those lessons learned. We want to share those with other agencies who might be embarking on similar efforts so that they can avoid making the same kinds of mistakes and hopefully optimize any effort they make to implement such a transformation. And if you're interested, on the very back page, there is a website where you can find more detail about our effort, and we're increasingly populating that with new information all of the time, including results that we continue to achieve, how we calculate those, working very hard to quantify all of our benefits, even if they aren't cash, trying to quantify them in dollar values, because we just think it's very important to reflect that there's a dollar value to almost everything we do. And we need to be able to quantify those results for the public and for yourself. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Well, I appreciate your testimony, and I'm curious. This is a relatively new initiative that's been undertaken, I assume, and so I'm guessing that at some point you're going to be able to really show some, I guess, results as you go along of what you have changed and what the dollar outcome that the agency sees in that change.
Absolutely. In our initial estimates of what we believe the dollar value of all the improvements could be, a biennial figure of between $250 and $400 million has been valued for each one of all of those initiatives put together. So far, we have achieved a quantified dollar value of about $33 million in benefits. Much of that has already resulted in budget reductions related to those transformation initiatives. One example, which is not in this write-up because it's fairly new, is a nursing home diversion program. So in our seniors and people with disabilities area, finding appropriate placements other than nursing homes where we can, and so diverting folks from that more expensive and maybe less quality of life care has already saved a significant amount, and more than that amount was already removed from the DHS budget in the last biennium, so we're kind of making it up after the fact. But it's working. It's probably our most significant dollar initiative to date.
Thank you. Sam Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was really impressed. Dr. Goldberg gave a presentation at the Committee for Performance Excellence, of which I'm a member, and I was impressed by the detail to which this goes, not just the very broad things, but some very detailed things. The example he gave, the number of steps removed from a purchasing an item. Mm-hmm. Went from, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but something like 17 steps down to 5 or something like, something in that range. And that was quite a savings right there. Just to go to that detail level, mm-hmm. To cut out expenses is pretty amazing.
Absolutely. I think there are a lot of, I'm sorry, Representative Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, there are a lot of quick wins, even in small dollar amounts, that really help people buy into this and want to do more of it in an environment where we're not going to have additional resources, but we often get additional demand for services. We have to figure out how to do more with what we have. And we see this as critical to being able to do that. Also, I think our other burning platform is that, as you know, we become two agencies in about a year and a half, and we would like this to be the foundation, the common management culture that we have between both of these agencies that help them to work well together.
Thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time and briefing us on that and providing us a link so that the members can browse that at their leisure. And I thank Dr. Goldberg for allowing you to come and keeping us informed. I hope we are able to hear more at a later date on some other results from this.
Happy to. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up, committee, we have an update on the Oregon Transparency website. Sean McSpaden and Marjorie Taylor. And I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Riley. I have to step out for a moment.
So if you just identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Absolutely. Vice Chair Riley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean McSpaden. I serve as Oregon's Deputy State Chief Information Officer, and I'm here this afternoon with Marjorie Taylor, who serves as a Senior Policy Advisor for the Department of Administrative Services. And we will, over the next few minutes, give you an overview of our progress on implementing House Bill 2500, which directed the Department of Administrative Services to establish an Oregon transparency website. What I'll do in the interest of time is speed through the first six or so slides that you have so we can focus most of our time on the website itself. As I mentioned, House Bill 2500 requires our department to develop and make available an Oregon transparency website by January 1st. We posted the site December 30th and continue to provide additional updates as needed. House Bill 2500 required a variety of reports to be available on the website, including reports on state agency revenues, expenditures, contracts, human resource expenses, a report on tax expenditures from the Department of Revenue, and also revenue information and a variety of other reports. As an example, existing state Secretary of State audit reports on a variety of state agencies. One of the key items I'd like to draw your attention to is on slide 3. This Oregon Transparency website was to be established and maintained essentially at no additional cost and within existing resources. And so what you'll see here in the next few minutes was put up essentially in the normal course of business for state agencies. We worked with a variety of state agencies to identify reports that they could provide in each of the areas, and that's what you'll see here today. The House Bill 2500 is applicable to all state agencies in the three branches of government, with the exception of the Oregon State Treasurer. House Bill 2500 also creates an Oregon Transparency Advisory Commission. It's a nine-member commission. Two of the members of that commission are with you all today, Representative Thatcher, Representative Smith. The role of the commission is to advise and make recommendations to the Oregon Department of Administrative Services regarding the creation, contents, operation of, and enhancements to the website over time. And finally, to report to the Legislative Assembly not later than January 15th of each odd-numbered year. And we certainly are supporting the Commission and will assist the Commission in developing that report later in the year. In terms of our progress or the actions that we've taken since the establishment of or adoption of House Bill 2500, we've held a variety of agency stakeholder meetings. We've held one-on-one meetings with each of the primary stakeholders in each of the report areas for revenue, expenditures, contracts, human resources, and the other miscellaneous reports. As I said, we have met with and support the Transparency Commission. The first meeting of the commission was held in December 17th. We demonstrated the site and received a variety of guidance from the commission at that time. And we launched the website December 30th. The last action that we needed to take is one that we'll take before the close of this week, and that's to post expenditure reports from the state agencies that we are working with. In our December meeting with the commission members, we expressed to them the need to allow agencies more time to review the expenditure reports to ensure that we did not inadvertently disclose information that that should be protected under the public records law or under the Oregon ID Theft Act or any other federal or state law or regulation. And so we've now completed that process. We have the reports. Should be able to post the expenditure information, as I said, before the end of the week. With that, I'll turn the microphone over to Marjorie Taylor, and she can walk you through the website itself.
Thank you, committee members. For the record, I'm Marjorie Taylor. I'm a senior policy advisor with the Department of Administrative Services. And I'll take you on a quick tour of the transparency website if you haven't had the opportunity to look at it before. First of all, I'd like to make note that we tried to pick a very simple website name, oregon.gov/transparency. You can get to this website from oregon.gov, but again, it's a snappy little name that we have here. On the website, we tried to divide it up into easy little sections. Again, state budget and agency performance, money coming in, otherwise known as revenues, money going out, expenditures, like Sean mentioned, we're going to put up by the end of the week, contracts and procurement, which I'll show you in just a moment because I know that's of interest today, especially state workforce. Also, information about the 2009-11 legislatively adopted budget and also the Oregon budget process. As Sean mentioned, we created this website with existing resources. For example, on the 2009-11 legislatively adopted budget, you'll see that we relied heavily on information that was already available through your legislative fiscal office. So again, directing the public to links that are already accessible, it might be a little easier to get to them from our website. Looking at state budget agencies and performance, again, relying on existing resources, using the Blue Book heavily, looking at agency budget information. We did create pie charts of total annual revenues from the 07-09 budget, just to give the public a general idea of, let me get to a pie chart. How revenues are divided up in agencies. It's easier to do this with a mouse. Sorry for the delay. So again, showing total available revenues in the 07-09 budget and then how they're divided up within each agency. Then we also linked to the key performance measures, as mentioned by some of the chief co-sponsors of the bill. Representative Smith was pretty interested in including that. Money coming in, did I already show this? We described the general fund, other funds, federal funds, lottery funds, what those mean. Also connected to the tax expenditure report, other information there. Again, linking to existing resources. Also, we linked to presentations that were given to the House and Senate Revenue Committees at the beginning of the 09 session. We linked to the audio presentations and also the PowerPoint presentations just so that the public can connect those two together. State workforce. This is where we posted salary data for state and university employees. When we met with the commission in December, they recommended that we not include individual names on this report, and you'll see that we did not do that. We tried to provide all of our reports in Excel format and CSV format, comma separated values, so that people who are visiting the site have the opportunity to download the data and manipulate it in other ways if they don't have Excel. So you'll see we've identified the agency, the classification, the service type, and then the annual salary. We provide disclaimers for what some of these mean. Again, the annual salary is 12 times the June 30th salary of those employees. The university system provided individual reports for each one of the universities. And then of particular interest today is the contracts and procurement. On this website, we took a snapshot of the ORPIN system. It's the Oregon Procurement Information Network that is housed at the Department of Administrative Services. It's a snapshot in time of contracts that are currently available on that page. For other agencies that we had to gather data from, we tried to standardize the format in terms of the columns of data that we requested from those agencies so that the public, as they were accessing these different reports, they weren't jumping from one style to another. So again, this is information that's currently available on the web in the ORPIN system. It's accessible to the public right now. What we did is we took a snapshot in time and have posted it here on this website. We've also gathered data from ODOT, from the lottery, and from the judicial department and the university system about contracts in their agencies. And again, if you take time to cruise around the website, you can look at those reports. At this time, we're planning to update the website probably at the end of the year. And in your packet of slides, we identified that as of February 5th, we've had approximately 3,400 unique visitors to the website. And those visitors are primarily visiting from Oregon. They're visiting the front page of the website and also the state workforce website. Most of them are from Salem and Portland, and then from some of the larger cities in Oregon.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, so Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you just said it. Maybe I missed the number. Did you give us a number of how many people are visiting it?
According to our Google Analytics, as of February...
10 billion.
Yes.
Because it's been fascinating so far. I mean, mm-hmm. Absolutely, you know, I'm a big fan.
So as of February 5th, December 28th to February 5th, we had 3,454 unique visitors to the website. That doesn't mean that's how many pages they visited. I think
right,
that's 27,000 pages. Yeah.
Vice Chair Riley, Representative Smith, members of the committee, those figures begin on page 10, I believe, in your packet.
Oh, so, thank you.
Yes. We'd be happy to answer questions.
Questions? Yes, Representative Smith.
I may have others, but I just want to offer an obligatory thank you for the work you guys did. I'll continue to do that for another couple of years until I, you know, get a wild hair about something else along with some friends. But no, I mean, there's a lot of work to do, a lot more to go. I have some thoughts, but I don't need to be first on those.
Right, and I'd like to echo that. I think this is a great step. I don't think we're where we want to be yet as far as the public being able to follow this very, very easily and find out what we're doing, be open and transparent. But it's a great step. Thank you very much.
I do have something if you're going to excuse them. Both to you guys and to other committee members, as we go forward, and I might not speak for myself in this, if folks have thoughts about the site, the bill, add-ons in the future, in general, helpful, a few areas really helpful. How do we provide context for this information so that it means something to people, right? Either comparing it with other states, comparing it to the private sector, comparing it to what we used to do, comparing what we might otherwise do, context so people understand it. Second, outcomes. How can we help people evaluate government, not only in terms of dollars, but also in terms of how we're performing? Third, interactivity, and maybe third and a half, user-friendliness. How can we make it so that not only a good government dork, you know, can, and for the record, I'm pointing at myself, not at other people, are interested in this, but that there's, you know, ways, hey, here's how to make your own budget, or, you know, here's a suggestion box, as I know there already is a link to offer things, but how can we increase interactivity and user-friendliness? At some point, some of that may take some dough, and would love for people's ideas in those areas, and again, thank you guys so much for the work you've done.
Yeah. Thank you, Marjorie and Sean. Appreciate it. So we're going to move on to the next topic, transparency in public contracting, and I want to call Stephanie Smythe and Diane Lancaster.
Chuck. all the Republicans about quarter after, so
okay.
What their schedule is.
Okay, thank you.
Other names that get you to that site.
Right.
And I know we're going to be losing some of the committee members soon because of another meeting, so I'm going to ask you to kind of summarize and move through as quickly as you can. So go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Riley and Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Stephanie Smythe, Assistant Attorney General. And specifically, the reason I think I've been asked to address this topic is I'm the attorney in charge of the business transaction section in the Department of Justice. We do the model public contract rules and have helped over the years with the model public contracting code, the public contracting code, and we handle a number of complex transactions for state agencies. So I was asked to talk about what the contracting code and the rules do to make contracting more transparent. And starting with the code, which many of you probably know was revised in major ways in 2003 and then has been amended in smaller ways since, there are many things that have to do with transparency. First of all, the code does govern contracting by both state and local governments. And it does have exceptions for some entities, both including the treasurer's office, the university system, the semi-independent agencies, the judicial and legislative departments, several other agencies. But for those that are subject to the code, the statutes require open source selection processes for contracts over $150,000. Below that, there can be small procurements and informal procurements that are not quite as open. But over $150,000, the regimen generally is competitive sealed bids or competitive sealed proposals, which are open publicly. And there are exceptions for those cases where you have an emergency or where there are demonstrated need to go for a sole source or a special type of procurement. Public notice is given 7 days before the opening of the bids or proposals, and it's done either in a newspaper or at the state level, it's done primarily electronically through the ORPIN system that's run by the Department of Administrative Services. The opening of proposals, they're opened in a manner that notifies the public who has bid or proposed. There can be information that is kept withheld from the public for a time while there is negotiation or while there is evaluation of the proposals. But after there's a notice of intent to award issued to the vendor that's selected, then that information is also public. There are also some exceptions for trade secrets or other materials that are exempt from public disclosure under the public records statutes, but that's rather small, and so the remainder of the material that has been submitted with a proposal or a bid is required to be disclosed. There are remedies given to both vendors and others to protest or seek judicial review where there have been violations of the public contracting code, including its openness provisions, and that includes the review of special procurements, the review of solicitations, the review of awards, and the review of violations of the contracting code, which begin at the administrative level and work up through judicial review. So moving on from the code and on to the public contracting rules, these are model rules that the Attorney General is required by statute to prepare and to promulgate every 2 years after every legislative session. We've just finished that process after the 2009 session. New rules were effective January 1st, 2010, and we're about to publish our manual of the model public contract rules and other authorities that are helpful for governments and vendors and others who are interested in public contracting. That will be published around April 1st. So the rules apply by default to local governments and state agencies that are subject to the code, and they can opt out of the rules, but in many cases they choose not to, particularly at the local government level. In any event, those rules provide a guide or a foundation for the adoption of rules that agencies may decide to adopt in lieu of the rules. Usually what we do is have advisory committees that are comprised of local government representatives, vendors from the private sector, and state agencies to help us promulgate those rules, because they're meant to be best practices as well as fill in the gaps that might be in the code. So we are lawyers. We are not necessarily the experts on the subject matter of what makes best practice in contracting. So we move from our role as legal advisors into facilitating committee work and promulgating rules on those best practices. We have, by statute, to consult with certain agencies in order to do the rules, and we do that. We have to give notice to interested persons, just like any other rules, and to legislators who were involved in the session within the last 2 years where any statutes were obeyed that affected the public contracting code and the rules. The rules do flesh out the particulars of how to give notice to the public and how to do electronic procurement in ways that the statutes do not, and allow time for requests for change and for protests. So in a nutshell, that's the overview of the transparency in the code and the rules.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Don't see any burning questions at the moment. I was kind of, maybe you're not the right person to ask this, but I apologize for coming in late, and I apologize for missing the transparency website part. But I'm kind of curious, because you said agencies can adopt these model rules or they can do their own.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you elaborate on that just a little bit, as far as if an agency doesn't adopt the model rules, which I think somebody else is here to talk to us about, how do they, I mean, what are their constraints for public contracting or abiding by the public contracting statutes then?
Well, they are constrained by the statutes. Those are a given, and the rules cannot vary from the statutes. They can only fill in gaps or provide supplemental requirements or provisions. So the code does govern everything that has to do with public contracting. If an agency is subject to the code, there are some, as I mentioned, that are accepted from the code. And as far as the application of the model rules, they do apply by default. So if an agency does not act to adopt its alternative rules and specifically opt out of our model rules, then they're governed by them. And that does happen quite often with particularly smaller local agencies that do not have the staff to promulgate rules.
And if you could catch me up just real briefly, and I apologize to the committee for this, but I was kind of curious about the agencies that aren't, I guess, subject to the public contracting codes. They're exempted from it.
Right.
And those are the Oregon University system, I'm seeing, the Secretary of State, and the judicial branch of government.
That's correct.
Oregon Correction Enterprises, which is the Department of Corrections, I'm guessing, or?
They are governed by a constitutional provision, and they do have requirements for complying with certain of the public contracting requirements. So
do they have their own statutory framework that they have to comply to and their own
rules? They do. And that predated the public contracting code itself.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Real quick, thank you, Mr. Chair. Along that same line, I understand the printing is a carve-out or an independent statutory authority. That's based upon the fact that we have a state printer, which we no longer have. So why are they still not part of the normal contracting process?
They are part of the regular contracting process. There are some provisions that are specific to state printing that require state agencies to go through the state printer to obtain printing services. But the state printer contracts those services out because of staffing and other issues. A large amount of printing is done under contract.
Thank you. I appreciate your
care.
Oh, Another question down there. Oh, Representative Thatcher.
I think it's a quick question. I was just looking through the transparency website. I was looking at ORPIN. Looking at ODOT. And it looks, and you're about to leave, so I couldn't get to what I was actually going to try to find. But are the announcements for bid openings in ORPIN?
Okay. Excuse me. Representative Colby, Representative Thatcher. For the record, I'm Diane Lancaster. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer at the Department of Administrative Services. And what I have shared with you has some features of Ms. Smythe's discussion as well. And there was a chart there that I think was a little bit helpful on page 2 that talks a little bit about the different independent statutory authorities that agencies have, and that might have been what Representative Holvey was keying on. So let us take a quick look at the rest of this document, and we'll talk a little bit about ORPIN. I think that what Stephanie has shared with you is the foundation, and one thing that the state of Oregon should be pleased with, and I work with states all over the country that have one, two, three, multiple different procurement codes. In this state, we are blessed with one, and that code applies to everyone. So when we look at a very highly decentralized government, which Oregon is one of the, as far as procurement is concerned, it is one of the most decentralized states in the United States. A great deal of authority is at the sites, at the various sites. What the Department of Administrative Services needs to do to assist in this, then, is to do what we have done with ORPIN. And ORPIN is the Oregon Procurement Information Network that you asked about, Representative. If you look at page 3 here, and you'll see the ORPIN logo, ORPIN is actually an electronic marketplace. And it is strictly that. As you can see, we now have over 41,000 vendors who are registered in ORPIN to do business. Over half of those, 57% of those, are Oregon businesses. So we have over 20,000 Oregon suppliers who are using ORPIN, and these are daily users. They are looking for solicitation opportunities. Now, if you flip then to the back of that, which is page 4, and you'll see that there is the ORPIN logon screen, and it has an access code that's circled in red. Now, that access code is one that any of you may use. I have the staff set it up especially for you, so that if you look at that and you, in your leisure moments, you go on, you can see what suppliers are seeing in terms of opportunities. When you go on to the site, you can see an average of 160 open solicitation opportunities that are there every day. They come in from all sorts of state and local government agencies, and the sample that we pulled, there were 41 different government agencies that had postings. 15 of those were local government for that particular day. So we opened this system up to create, again, that statewide electronic marketplace so that local government and state agencies alike can use it. All of the solicitation information is transparent. Everything is available to anyone, and this is free of charge. There are active and expired contracts, and you just saw a snapshot from the new transparency website that if you drilled in, I think Marjorie keyed in on one page where you could start seeing some of the contract items there. If you go into ORPIN, you can look at that real-time, any day, 24/7, 365, and you can look at open, expired contracts. You can sort them by type. You can look at professional services or technical services. You can even look at intergovernmental agreements, which is something that many folks have a deep interest in. So, for example, the Department of Human Services does work with local counties. You can look at those intergovernmental agreements at this site. Construction, certainly, other types of services and goods are also included. I thought the committee might be interested, because ORPIN is a statewide resource, in knowing about how many local governments are actually engaged and using it. We took the liberty of sorting them. There are actually 484 local governments who are have signed an intergovernmental agreement with us and who are using our services on a daily basis. And you'll see there's a chart, and this is on the top of page three, that shows the breakout of those members. You have cities, counties, school districts, special districts, and other nonprofit and other local smaller entities that are using ORCAP. They call it ORCAP, and it's called the Oregon Cooperative Purchasing Program. The local governments can use all of the electronic bid advertising features of ORPIN, and of course they can access all of the price agreements that my agency puts together for office supplies and fleet vehicles and computers and anything and everything that a local government or a state agency might need to buy. I took the liberty of looking up what cities and areas that you folks represent, and I'm sorry, ma'am, Representative Thatcher, you're the one that we missed, but I'll provide this to your office. But we got, I think I counted every other person at the table today, and I thought you might be interested in just seeing what types of local entities in your areas are currently using our Oregon Procurement Information Network. And you can see that it is significant in all of your communities. Finally, then, because this is an electronic marketplace and our job is to bring buyer and seller together, it's critical that we have not just the state agencies but those local government agencies using ORPIN, because, again, this is where we can capture those solicitation opportunities, get good value for the state agencies and local governments, good competition, and then, of course, suppliers. This is where the suppliers can find everything from soup to nuts. The lowest dollar value is $5,000. So you will see contracts all the way from $5,000 to $50 million posted on ORPIN. It really is an interesting site if you have a chance to go out and take a look at it. Finally, then, we did provide a couple of upcoming outreach activities. Again, we are constantly trying to outreach to let government people know and to let suppliers know that ORPIN is there for them. And that is what we do. And I also thought to bring you, this is an electronic newsletter that goes out to the local government entities called the Cooperative Connection. It is just published last week, and I thought you might enjoy having a flavor of the types of things that we share with local government, and this is through an electronic newsletter that goes out to all of those folks. Be happy to answer any questions. I know you're tight for time this evening.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Tomei.
Not really a question, but I am so impressed with this. This is just brilliant.
Thank you, ma'am.
How long has it been in operation?
Oh, ORPIN actually went live in 2005, and it's a very nice system. It's limited, so it's not attached to the accounting payment information, but for what it is, it's a good, stable system. And you can see on page 2, there's a little chart that shows that when we started registering, we grew from literally supplier 1 to now the 41,716 suppliers that were registered when we took this snapshot.
That's
so
terrific.
It has been well received, and we continue to work to make it known to everyone. So appreciate that. Thank you, ma'am.
So by statute, I believe when you do a request for a proposal or something, you're required to advertise that. So does ORPIN satisfy that requirement?
Yes, Representative Holby. ORPIN satisfies completely that requirement. And the Legislative Assembly, one of the changes it made with the new code that went into effect about the same time ORPIN went live in 2005 was to require that any interstate work that we do, any cooperative work that we do, must be advertised on ORPIN in addition to all of the state agency solicitations. The local governments are voluntary. They don't have to use ORPIN. So, again, we're very proud of that because that means ORPIN is useful for them. But, yes, ma'am, these, and Representative Holvey, these advertisements are must for the state agencies and then voluntary on the part of the local governments that wish to expand their competition.
So I'm curious between the state agencies, because some are general fund state agencies and some are other funds, and so because you said this is absolutely free, and so I'm curious of the is this a general fund expenditure then, or does it also include other funds from agencies that are collected
sure.
through fees.
Representative Holvey, members of the committee, it is free for the suppliers to register on ORPIN. The actual support of the system is through my office, through the State Procurement Office. We actually receive our income through a vendor-collected administrative charge that is a percentage of a contract purchase. So, for example, if a local government purchases a police motorcycle, for example, there will be a small charge that they will that will be tacked on for that, usually under 1%. So that, and then we do have a DAS, or Department of Administrative Services, assessment to state agencies who are subject to our procurement authority, and that accounts for a significant portion of our budget as well. But the local government participation has increased to the point where both in volume and in revenue, we are at about a third, 30, 35, maybe pushing 40% of the total purchases that we are able to aggregate together to get best value. So we're very pleased with that.
Great. Thank you for that overview.
Thank you.
I appreciate your testimony and making yourself available, and certainly if we have more questions after thinking about your material, I'm sure that some of us may call you.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, I'll have to check with my vice chair. I think I have Clyde.
Yeah, I just did his first chair.
Clyde Psyche and Stella Tranchu.
Yeah.
And Tammy Dorham. Dorman, excuse me. It may seem like you all should come up separately from different agencies, but I am running a little bit over, so I apologize if I end up shorting your presentation as members are leaving, but I did want to hear from your particular agencies on public contracting as well.
Okay.
Thank you. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Sure. Chair Holvey and members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Deputy for Central Services for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And the handout, I provided written testimony and also a handout just hitting the high points of the testimony, and I'll work off of that. And in the interest of time, a lot of information that Ms. Lancaster and Ms. Smythe provided also pertains to us, so I'll move quickly over that section. On page 2, it just talks about a list of principles of competitive procurement. As a public agency, we're governed by federal and state laws and regulations. This includes governance from the Federal Highway Administration for funding we receive from them, rules and regulations around federal stimulus money, as well as we are also subject to the public contracting law in the state of Oregon, ORS 279. And there's a number of reasons why that's important, but the bottom line is really to ensure a fair and competitive process that has a high degree of integrity. On page 3, just a high-level view of ODOT outsourcing. The first bullet talks about our statewide transportation investment plan contracts. Those are the highway and bridge construction contracts. And then the second bullet talks about the other contracting work we do in support services such as engineering and design, highway maintenance, information technology, training, upkeep and maintenance on our offices, DMV offices in particular. On page 4, a little more information about our highway construction contracts. Highway construction contracts are about 70% of the money we contract out. In a given year, we contract for about $460 million, which covers approximately 90 projects. On page 5, the non-construction projects, goods and trade services, annually we do about $28 million in that arena with about 1,500 contract transactions. And under the second bullet, there's some examples of the kind of work we do in that category. On page 6, we talk about transparency in the contracting process. We provide advance notice of projects on ODOT websites and on ORPIN, which you just heard about. And if you turn to page 9, I've provided a list of ODOT websites where we announce contracts that are going to be available. The advertisement and award information is public electronically. We have a lot of collaborative communication with our industry stakeholder groups. A lot of public involvement on projects. As part of the State Transportation Investment Plan, there's a big public involvement component of that. Public, local area planning groups, as well as public input, public forums. Outreach events for the supplier community. And then procurement process documentation. Once an intent to award is made, is open, subject to the public records law, and so we provide it, except for cases of personal information and proprietary information. And then the final bullet, contractors and public, the public may attend bid openings, and for all our construction projects where the majority of the money is contracted out in, we announce that, and if you turn to page 9, the first bullet, ODOT construction website, we announce all our public, all our bid openings to the public, and routinely we have actually quite a few people show up to those bid openings. Slide 7, advertisement and outreach programs. Do a lot of educational outreach, work very closely with the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business Office in the Governor's Office, working to try to increase the contractor pools and reach out to contractors who don't usually work with us. Again, in the second bullet, as I said earlier, citizens and local communities are work with us in the development of the statewide transportation improvement program. We advertise contracting opportunities in specific journals like the Daily Journal of Commerce. And the Office of Civil Rights works very closely in enforcing federal civil rights requirements so that we will not discriminate against any contractors as they seek work with ODOT. The final slide, 8, is about the transparency website. We've worked very closely with DAS, and I think many of you saw when they clicked on the contracts and procurement section, there was an ODOT section, and so we've worked with them to make sure that we get our contract information up there for people to see. And with that, I'll stop and see if there's any questions.
Thank you for that brief overview, and
you're welcome.
Appreciate you taking the time to put this together for us as well.
You're welcome.
You could identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I'm Stella Transu, the administrator of the Office of Contracts and Procurement within Department of Human Services. Thanks for the opportunity to let us share some contracting information with DHS. Just to give you an idea of the number of contracts, in a biennium we have about 7,500 contracts and about 300 solicitations. We advertise on ORPIN, which you've heard, and we are under DAS authority except for a few of our, we have our own authority for Oregon State Hospital, for our managed care contracts, and then for housing for the mentally ill. And we also have delegated authority for our client services. Just to give you an example of when we don't do solicitations, all of our residential placements, most of them need to be licensed, and then we would have a contract with them. We have many contracts with government entities, many counties, and those are not solicited. Those are entered into directly, and that's with ORS 190 because of government entities. And then many of our child welfare contracts, excuse me, are, we find those locally. People know of local entities that can help children. Those are entered into with a child name contract. So none of those are put on ORPIN for solicitation. Some of the advantages for us for having our own authority, our own delegation, is the knowledge of DHS contract practices, awareness of our program needs, the familiarity with our program staff, and the ability to prioritize requests and redirect staff as we need them. Suzanne mentioned earlier about transformation at DHS, and that's also impacting the contracting arena. We are moving to contracting by category rather than by division. Previously, it was child welfare contracting. Now we are moving to the type of contract like transportation or residential, IT, things like that. So we are working on that. And the advantages for that are workload efficiencies, improving the contract knowledge base of our staff, enhanced coverage capacity, strategically purchase goods and services across program divisions to save dollars also. As part of our desire to improve services and folks that access them, we had a recent experience with one of our outreach grants for Healthy Kids. Now, ORPIN works pretty well. In fact, it works great for the average vendor or entity business that's working with the state. But it doesn't work so well for the one-time small group that is wants to do an outreach grant, such as these Healthy Kids were. So I've been tasked with looking at how else we can advertise these opportunities for grants, because those are outside of the contracting code. So we would still use ORPIN just because it's a nice central entity for folks to find businesses, like to find business opportunities, but we also want to have other opportunities for small groups to find these opportunities.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And our last testifier, if you'd identify yourself, please.
Representative Holvey and members of the committee, I'm Tammy Dorman. I'm with the Department of Corrections. I'm the Assistant Director for General Services. I first want to clarify, I'm only speaking for the Department of Corrections. OCE, which you mentioned before, operates like a semi-independent kind of agency. So just to make sure that they have their own rules in contracting. So I won't bore you with all the things that we do that's pretty much like everybody else described. So I'll just point out a couple different little things that I've got in my testimony. We do use ORPIN, but we also utilize any other way that we can communicate. Sometimes on big architect and engineering things, we'll advertise in newspapers, like if we're going to build a prison or do a big remodel to a prison. We also create lists that we can use within ORPIN that maybe a vendor hasn't yet registered. So like we do that with food. We'll know that food vendors that are out there, and then once they bid, then they can join the ORPIN and be on the list to get other solicitations. We also did, we joined up with DAS on the vendor outreach for Go Oregon, but we also, because we have prisons in places that they weren't going to touch, we did our own kind of outreach for some of our Go Oregon projects, like Ontario. Not a lot of people go out there, but there are vendors there, and we use them. We do put our stuff on ORPIN for about 2 weeks, so vendors really have time to look at it and process it, unless it's an emergency. And I don't know if anybody mentioned that the results of the bids and who gets what and what all the prices were is actually posted on ORPIN. So if you're a vendor that wants to propose next time, you can see what everybody else, what their prices were and who got the successful bid. So that's an important thing for vendors to see too. So
thank you for clarifying that. I was going to ask that at some point whether bid results were posted anywhere too, but that's also on ORPIN as well.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Oh, I have a question.
Representative Tomei, a question.
Thank you. When you mentioned food, I seem to recall that fairly recently there was a huge issue about procurement.
Yeah. Do you want me to represent Tomei and members of the committee? So that was several years ago. And since then, we actually had our director, Max Williams, had an independent group come in and review our purchasing and our fiscal things around food. Actually, Stephanie Smythe, that you heard today, she was the lead person on the committee. We had Division of Audits. We had the Internal Control Officer from the Department of Administrative Services, and someone from Diane Lancaster's staff did a review, gave us a huge amount of recommendations, which we have been implementing those. One of the things that we did not do prior to that was the food was not on ORPIN. Ms. Mr. Monum just made deals with people. All the food now is on Orpin. We've actually increased the number of vendors that are bidding. We do vendor analysis reports to see if we're using a vendor too much. What is the reason for using that vendor, more than 10%? We do a lot of analysis and looking. Plus, we have our own internal audit staff that are reviewing our processes too. So it really was a blessing in disguise. There's always a silver lining in the cloud. It was hard to go through, but we've really made our processes a lot better, and internal controls are stronger.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and I think that holds true for a lot of us. When we make mistakes, we figure out better ways to avoid them in the future. So I appreciate this overview to you and to the others that participated in it. It's a really broad overview for this committee, obviously, and there may be an opportunity in the future to drill down a little bit more on some of these topics. They may or may not involve you specifically. Time will tell. And I really appreciate you taking the time and giving us your materials and your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Committee, I appreciate your attention to this important subject, and I think it gives us a kind of a broad overview of different things that are going on in the state around transparency, government accountability, and our core functions, and cost efficiency, and I think there's a lot of material to in this arena, and I hope that we can look at some of these things and pick something specifically that may bring some ideas forward in the interim and some issues that we may want to address if there are any. Certainly am open to any suggestions from anyone on the committee, and I'm sure my vice chairs will pass that on to the other members, that we are open to suggestions on specific items in this broad and large arena. So, committee, I think tentatively we are scheduled for another interim committee informational meeting on Wednesday, no meeting on Thursday. I don't know if floor session is going to interfere with that, Patrick. Any indication on that?
Mr. Chair, committee staff have been solicited by the Speaker's office to find out what committees are planning informational meetings for Wednesday and what times they're planning those for, and are going to plan floor sessions if possible around those. And we're not the only committee meeting at 3:30 on Wednesday. So I suspect that unless there's an urgent need to finish, which is always possible, that we'll be able to hold our regularly scheduled meeting.
So until
we're certainly hoping that's the case.
Yeah, until I may want to discuss that with you a little bit tomorrow and make a judgment call, since I think we have people traveling from out of country, maybe they or out of state, and they've already gotten plane tickets probably and things. So we'll have to figure that out. So with that, Representative Smith, something for the order?
Yeah, I just wanted to say something quick. First of all, I want to say thanks. I thought it was valuable, and I'm speaking that to you because, well, I guess there are a couple people here. but also, to me, I hope the thing we'll come to grips with is how, and I was actually glad to have some of these sort of in order, to come to grips with how these pieces sort of fit together, how they're interrelated, and where are the gaps. And I think if we could spend some time thinking about, where those gaps are, try to fill those, could create some connective tissue or get rid of some, irrelevant tissue. That would be valuable, but thanks. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that was really my intent, was to get as broad an overview of different aspects of this and to maybe identify what we could do or what we could look at to help this process along with the executive branch of government, because I think they've done a lot of work on this, and we ought to not redo it, but use them in a concert with some of our ideas and our Ways and Means process as well. So
great.
Throw a little policy in there if we get a chance.
Thanks.
All right. With that, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability and closing the informational meeting at the same time.